Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. This is Andrea Bernstein, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Despite the gridlock and constant filibustering that have characterized this Senate session, the confirmation vote for Elena Kagan seems destined to sail through easily later today. It's one of the last pieces of business for the Senate this week before their recess, but the confirmation vote might be a continuation of the surprising movement we saw yesterday, a $26 billion aid package to states and school districts broke through a Republican filibuster. So what was wrapped up and what's being left on the table as unfinished Senate tasks? Is the Senate shredding the gridlocked label? Let's ask Todd Zwillick, the Washington correspondent, for the takeaway. Todd, welcome back to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi, good morning, Andrea.
So let's talk first about Kagan. Any late hiccups in the confirmation process?
Well, you know, there haven't been any hiccups. And the eerie thing about the debate on her final confirmation on the floor this week is that you hardly would have known it was going on. You know, certainly senators are making speeches on the floor, but in the hallways of the Senate, no one's talking about it. People are talking about jobs, and they're talking about Medicaid, as you mentioned, and they were talking about the energy bill this week because it imploded, and they're certainly talking about the polls and the impending midterm elections. But you wouldn't know there's an associate justice of the Supreme Court about to be confirmed by the Senate as early as today. Nobody's talking about it. She's a shoo-in at this point.
Now, walk us back a little bit. How did this happen? I mean, this is sort of the legendary, most oppositional Senate ever in history. George Packer has just done this huge New Yorker exposition about how it's completely degenerated and nobody gets along and everybody's talking about it. And yet something that you would think would be incredibly contentious, a U.S. Supreme Court nomination, has been almost ho-hum.
That's true. And I think what you describe from George Packer's article is largely true, except that the old axiom that you choose your battles is the truest of them all. It's true that the Senate is highly partisan, highly polarized, relationships are frayed, we're on the cusp of an election. All of those things normally would be ingredients to a very ugly fight. But keep in mind a couple of things. Elena Kagan, first of all, is not expected to largely change the ideological makeup of the court. So Republicans who would oppose her, and most of them do oppose her, probably don't have as much motivation to go to the mat in opposing her. And secondly, you have to remember that while filibusters or objections in the Senate have become incredibly common, especially this year, more demands for 60 votes in the last year and a half to 2 years than really in the last 30 years of Senate history. I might be overstating it a bit, but it's at least 25 years. Filibusters on Supreme Court nominees are a different story. And you remember back in 2005, the Senate was on the brink of a meltdown. It was even called the nuclear option.
I do remember.
Right.
Now, the nuclear option has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. It had to do with a change in the Senate rules, right?
And yes, and filibusters of Supreme Court nominees. And at that time, the shoe was on the other foot. The Democrats were in the minority, and they wanted to, and Republicans were considering changing the rules because Democrats were stymieing their judges getting
on the
court.
So what was the nuclear option? It's very insightful, I think, into the U.S. Senate, right?
Yeah, it is. And this would have been a quirky way to change the rules, saying we will maintain the filibuster, the need for 60 votes to move controversial legislation, except in the cases of judicial nominees, where we will make the threshold a simple majority, 51. What that boils down to is that the minority, in that case the Democrats, would have lost their right to block any controversial nominee. And this really struck a lot of people the wrong way in both parties, the institutionalists, the people who sort of want to protect the Senate's position as a place where debate takes longer, where you don't just rubber stamp things the way the House can do sometimes. It was called the nuclear option because if they had changed the rules in that way, a lot of people thought it would have eviscerated a lot of Senate traditions. And if you think relationships are frayed now, Andrea, thing, it would have been a total meltdown. A lot of people were afraid the Senate would have frozen up for years because of a move like this. It took 14 senators. It was called the Gang of 14 at the time. There were seven Republicans and seven Democrats who formed their own bloc, who basically said, we won't support, there were enough of them to take away votes on either side. And they said, we won't support this nuclear option. We won't support any filibusters of judicial nominees except in extraordinary circumstances. And Elena Kagan, that rule, by the way, the Gang of 14 rule is unofficial. It's informal, but it still hangs over the Senate. Elena Kagan was not considered in an extraordinary circumstance by most Republicans. And so I think any idea of trying to filibuster her, calling her an extraordinary circumstance, somebody who you just can't trust to get on the court, really didn't hold here. No filibuster.
Well, the Gang of 14, I remember that was back in the days when John McCain was trying to be the Senate conciliator.
He was in that group. That's right. And he's running in a primary in Arizona and wearing a different hat right now.
And that, which brings us to the question of, is the Elena Kagan vote going to resonate in any of these primaries or these elections that are coming up in the fall?
Well, most of the Republicans who you want to look at the Republicans who will vote for her. For the most part, right? Most of the Democrats will be comfortable voting for her. Most of the Republicans will be comfortable voting against her. Five Republicans have come out for her, and none of them is in a reelection race right now. Judd Gregg of New Hampshire is voting for her. He's a conservative, but he's retiring. He has nothing to worry about. Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins are both moderates from Maine, and neither of them is up for reelection right now. They have nothing to worry about. Now, Lindsey Graham is an interesting case. He is not up for election now. He's up for election in 2012, but he's already under attack in South Carolina from conservatives because Lindsey Graham is sort of the new John McCain in a way, and I don't want to overstate the comparison, but he has been continuing to do a lot of reaching across the aisle, even in this environment where if you extend your hand across the aisle, you might get it chopped off. There's a couple of Republicans who've learned that lesson lately. Lindsey Graham has said he voted for Kagan in committee. He says he'll vote for her on the floor. He says he believes that he likes to say elections have consequences. The president won the election. He has a right to appoint someone. She's qualified. She gets on the court. I'm sticking to my guns on this. I think Lindsey Graham is trying to sort of diffuse some of the age-old acrimony around judicial nominees, and I imagine he'll expect some payback from Democrats once he's in the majority.
So, are there any races where Kagan could be an issue? Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, she tipped her hat on how she's going to vote?
It's always a possibility. Blanche Lincoln has not tipped her hat. I would be surprised if she voted no at this point on, again, a nominee who's not going to change the ideological face of the court. Now, the next nominee that comes around may well change it, depending on who retires next. So, we'd have to watch that. You do have to watch the Blanche Lincolns of the world. She is up for a tough re-election fight in a conservative state, even though she is a Democrat. I would definitely watch the way she votes on that. And I'm trying to think about another moderate Democrat off the top of my head who you might want to watch. Only one Democrat, Andrea, has announced that he'll vote against Kagan. That's Ben Nelson, conservative Democrat of Nebraska, who it's not terribly surprising. He's got big conservative credentials and he works hard to maintain them. He's from Nebraska, after all, with a D after his name, so he'll be a no vote.
Is there something particular that the conservatives are objecting to in Elena Kagan's past? Is it the Harvard don't ask, don't tell recruitment? Is it the fact that she worked for Obama? What is it that they are using or gearing up to use in some of these races?
Well, it's all of those things. It is her time at Harvard as dean, which was multifaceted, by the way. Republicans are very upset about the episode where she upheld a Harvard policy that basically kept military recruiters out of university facilities because they viewed the don't ask, don't tell policy as discriminatory. I should say it was not a Pentagon policy. It was a law that don't ask, don't tell was written by Congress, not the Pentagon. Republicans are very upset that she essentially, in their view, punished the military for something that Congress had done. At the same time, conservatives were very happy with Kagan as dean at Harvard because she got to Harvard Law School and said, you know, there aren't enough conservative minds teaching at this school. There aren't enough conservative minds in the academic debate. And she moved aggressively to recruit more of them to be part of the environment at Harvard. They liked her then when she did that. So it's been a mixed bag. The other big thing I think that they're using against her is her lack of judicial experience. She's never been a judge. She's been Solicitor General, but only for 6 or 7 cases. She hasn't been in that post for very long, arguing cases before the Supreme Court. Yeah. And before that, she was a political animal at the White House, and they think she'll remain political on the court.
You want to game the vote?
Yeah, I think we can come pretty close to gaming it. There are 59 Democrats. Nelson's a no. That brings you to 58 plus 5 Republicans. I think what's 58 plus 5?
58 plus 5 would be 63.
I think we'll land around 63, one or two surprises. Let's say 63 to 64.
All right. And that is so we will be watching that, as that unfolds later today. And that is right around where the $26 billion aid bill for education systems and state governments passed late yesterday.
Well, they overcame a procedural hurdle. It will pass officially later today. What we saw yesterday was, the cloture vote. People get a little twisted up on that. But the important vote was yesterday. You're right about that. And they got 62 votes for it. Now, this was a bit of a surprise. You kind of had to do a double take yesterday when the Senate passed something. You know, I mean, they have been so tied up lately. This is an election year. And as you said off the top, Andrea, it is absolutely acrimonious now. Wall Street regs passed, but only barely, and after a lot of torturous negotiations, the Senate is finished doing things of substance. But the White House has been lobbying quietly and aggressively for this $26 billion package for a couple of weeks, in fact, longer than that. And it's come up at the end of the session here. This is going to send, I think they said in the newscast, $2 billion in aid for Medicaid to the state of New York, not to mention $607,000 for teachers. So it's a big deal for New York, and it's a big deal for a lot of jurisdictions around the country because the states are always strapped for Medicaid cash. It is their cost leaders. States spend more on Medicaid than any other thing, and education is number two. And when the economy goes bad, it's a double crunch because not only are healthcare costs going up, but when the economy goes south, fewer people are working, they don't have money, they go on Medicaid, and those costs rise even more. States have less revenue, but they have more costs. It's a real crunch for them. So this money is going to prevent a lot of people from losing their healthcare.
Well, yeah. I mean, just, you know, point of clarification, I think that the New York budget, functional and brilliant that it is, had sort of put that money in the bank before the official vote. But it does make me wonder, a lot of Republican governors have lobbied their fellow Republicans in the Senate about some of these state aid measures because the states are in such serious fiscal straits this year. And, you know, last year, a lot of them got this big pump of stimulus money, which sort of, you know, prevented the kind of fiscal unraveling that we've seen in a lot of states this year. But I'm wondering what it is that makes the Senate resist that. I mean, in this case, they passed the bill, but, you know, as you say, only after a lot of work. And, you know, a lot of Republicans also have to run states and don't want them to cease functioning. So what is it that is sort of creating that kind of almost an ideological rift in the Republican Party?
A couple of things. I think, first of all, spending has become poisonous in Washington. The deficit, jobs and deficit are the two big issues, and a lot of Republican base voters are really, really upset about the size of the deficit. Now, we should say this bill does not increase the deficit. It is paid for. You can argue whether the so-called pay fors, they're raising some taxes, closing some offshore tax loopholes and tax breaks for big businesses and stuff like that. Some people think some of that math is a bit of a shell game, and I think you can make that argument. But the bottom line is that the deficit needle doesn't move. So spending has become toxic in this environment after the stimulus, after TARP, after the wars and all these things. People are sick of spending. So another $26 billion, that's more spending. I think the other thing is that I think what the White House really wants to do here, sure, they don't want people to lose their health care and they don't want teachers to lose their jobs. That's true. Let's take them at face value. They also can't afford for that jobs number, that unemployment number, to move up so close to the election. They want to keep that needle at least where it is, and that's important, and this money will help do that. If you're a Republican, why the heck would you help so close to an election that you're about to beat the Democrats up on? I think that's part of the political calculation.
Well, it's a complicated calculus because some of Republicans also need to get reelected or elected, as we're going to be talking about actually in the next part of the hour about the Connecticut race, which is something that the Republicans are sort of moving aggressively to win, is the governor's mansion. No one sort of, I think, wants to have their state fall apart on their watch.
That's right. And some of them have a good way of the way there already. So you see the difficult political dynamics going on there. Republicans have a big advantage. They don't want to give it up in a lot of states.
Now, I want to talk about the energy bill in just a moment. But now first, Nancy Pelosi sent out a tweet yesterday saying the House is going to have to come back.
Nancy Pelosi breaking news on Twitter. We're all emailing her staff saying, is she going to call him back? Is she not going to call him back? They say, we'll get back to you. All of a sudden, the Twitter lights up and you say, okay, the speaker just announced it via Twitter. That's fine. Who is she? Kanye West? You know, it was really something.
I guess so, right?
Yeah,
Tom
right.
Williams, right?
So that'll be Tuesday. The speaker, the Senate said this is an emergency. We need this money for teachers and firefighters. We can't wait any longer. So now the pressure was on the speaker. Okay, if it's such an emergency, Madam Speaker, are you going to call the House back? And she eventually said yes. They'll be back on Tuesday to vote this through. That should be a smooth vote. The Democrats have the majority. You might pick up a couple of Republican votes, maybe not. The Republican leadership has already attacked this bill as a bit of a sham, but they got a big majority in the House, so she'll call them back in. I think what you'll see is a bit of a bungee jump effect, members kind of dipping in, voting, and then getting right back out again.
Yes,
they won't hang
how
around.
Happy then can they be about interrupting their August time in their districts,
yeah.
Which sort of brings us to the issue of, you know, last August was really kind of a pivotal moment in the health care debate. It seemed like it was... I would say it seemed like it was going relatively well for Obama. And then everybody went home and there were these town hall meetings. And I put that in quotes because a lot of them were sort of, this astroturf, the sort of false grassroots efforts to organize people. But they represented also a real sentiment and a lot of the sort of debate got stalled there because there were a lot of people that were sort of beginning to express a lot of anxiety, upsetness, sort of other kind of anti-healthcare passage sentiment. So August was which is usually a dead month. And, we're sort of talking about who divorced who or maybe a murder case or something like that. Got hugely filled on cable news by healthcare. Are we expecting anything like that to happen this year?
Well, we do have Bristol Palin news, so take heart. We'll still be able to do some of that. I think she's on again, off again with Levi. So don't think it's going to be all
right. And also, great
substance.
Fodder for the tabloids in New York was Caroline
right.
Giuliani's arrest. So,
of course.
The daughters and sons of the political class will sort of continue to keep us entertained. But what about substantively? Do you think anything is going to happen?
Well, you have to watch immigration. I think that Republicans are having some success motivating their side on the immigration issue, which could come up. In the fall, it may or may not. That might be early next year after the election. But the Republican base is extremely fired up on immigration, on border security. You're hearing rumblings about maybe we should tinker with the 14th Amendment that guarantees U.S. citizenship to anyone born in the United States, even if their parents are undocumented or illegal. Those kinds of things are motivating Republicans. And I think you also might want to watch taxes.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. because that seems a kind of a double-edged sword for Republicans, right? I mean, they can excite their base by talking about immigration, but can they win? I mean, does it hurt them, only 2 months later?
Well, maybe, but this is base time right now. Especially now, there's still primaries going on. This is about the base. And midterms generally are about the base. You say, well, Republicans run a risk if they're talking only about border security, or some of them are talking about get tough on immigration or the 14th Amendment or supporting SB 170 in Arizona, all of these things extremely unpopular with Hispanic voters especially, do they risk alienating Hispanic voters? Of course, the answer is yes, they do. But that risk is a lot lower than the big motivation for base Republican voters, conservatives who care about immigration, who are on the other side of this issue and are fired up for this election. I don't think you would see quite the same devotion to it and quite the same level of rhetoric from either side, frankly, if this were 2012 and you were headed to a general election where it's about going to the middle, about corralling as many voters in the middle as possible.
It's kind of the Arlen Specter effect. It doesn't really matter if you can't get past the primary.
That's right.
So, and what about John McCain? Is he, I mean, I know he's been sort of moving far to the right of the positions that he held, certainly as a senator and even as a presidential candidate. Does he
not according to him?
Well, I think you could go back and document.
Sure. I would agree with you, by the way.
Where he is. I mean, for example, I haven't heard John McCain speaking extremely loudly about campaign finance reform in the last, months.
No, you heard him remain silent after the Supreme Court ruling against the bill that he authored. That's right.
Right. So I'm wondering, I mean, I know that he does want to not lose a primary, but is that a possibility?
Well, no. John McCain is well ahead of his Republican primary challenger, J.D. Hayworth, former congressman and current radio host in Arizona. He's doing well, but I think McCain and a lot of other Republicans learned an important lesson by watching Senator Robert Bennett in Utah, who lost his primary. In fact, he didn't even get to the primary, Andrea. He's an incumbent senator with fantastic conservative credentials who lost in the party nominating convention, never even got a chance to get to the primary. Why did that happen? One, he voted for TARP. And two, largely this was it. He cooperated with a Democrat, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, on a health care bill that never even got to the floor. It never even became a huge part of health reform. It was talked about. The very fact that he had reached across the aisle and joined hands with a Democrat, who was largely a liberal Democrat, was enough to turn off and disgust and anger, again, those base conservative Republican voters in Utah. Robert Bennett is out. He's not going to be a senator after January. Somebody like John McCain sees that, and he says, forget about all of this bipartisan cred, patients' bill of rights, immigration reform, global warming, campaign finance. All that McCainian stuff that he used to be famous for, that's
the press
out. That's not
as, how, as his base.
That's not how you win this election in 2010. This is a polarized environment. It's a rather angry environment. The right is fired up. They don't like Barack Obama, and you want to be as far away from any kind of branding of bipartisanship with this president and these Democrats as possible, and John McCain knows it.
By the way, what I was referring to was that McCain used to call reporters his base when he would get on on the Straight Talk Express, and he would say, you know, here's my base, and I would be shocked to hear that from the John McCain 2010 model. Let's just quickly wrap up by sort of talking about what happens in the fall. Anything in the Senate, in the House?
Well, I'll tell you one big thing. The tax cuts are expiring. The Bush tax cuts are going to expire. They're huge. Democrats have a plan. They want to renew those tax cuts for the middle class, and they want to let them expire for anyone making $250,000 a year or more. To Republicans, that is a big tax increase. There's going to be a fight over it, and Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is sending signals that he wants to have that fight in September or October in the run-up to the election. Remind voters. Now, again, a lot of those $250,000 or more, most of them, not all of them, are going to be Republican voters. And Harry Reid seems to be calculating that it's going to be a great time to remind voters whose side who is on. Democrats are for the little guy in the middle class. Republicans are for the rich. We'll have that fight in September, October. I think that's going to be the big one. There might also be an energy fight, but taxes is going to be huge.
The energy bill, is whimpering off into the night?
Oh, it's completely unraveled. Over the last couple of months, it has been like pulling one piece of yarn after another on a sweater, and it's just a big pile on the floor now. To extend that metaphor, they started with a grand vision of comprehensive energy reform, really reordering the American energy economy. And at the heart of it was cap and trade, capping carbon emissions, pricing carbon, and controlling global warming. That never really got off the ground. And then they said, well, we'll just do it for utilities. Let's not reach for big manufacturing. Let's not reach for cars yet. That's too complicated. The Senate's too polarized. We'll just do utilities. They couldn't get that. Then they went for this narrow little energy bill that included some easy stuff. Let's crack down on BP. Let's crack down on drillers and improve environmental standards, safety standards for drilling. That should be a no-brainer. And we'll put in some money for electric and hybrid cars, which was bipartisan, by the way. The bill that carries that stuff is completely bipartisan. undoable. Undoable. They could not get agreement on how to move forward with this stuff. The Senate, except for the surprise of this $26 billion that is going to pass today, the Senate is basically has shut down for the election year for now. They're going to have this fight over taxes, and Harry Reid will try to maneuver that fight to his advantage if he can. But in terms of energy policy, it's on the floor for now. That's going to have to come back in the fall.
Thanks very much, Todd Zwillick, who is the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway and also a regular blogger for Transportation Nation. Thanks so much for joining us with this very comprehensive wrap-up. And we will continue to talk about politics and who wants to be in the Senate next year when we talk about the Connecticut primary for both governor and senator, which is, believe it or not, next week, coming up right after this.